So this is the first panel discussion of the meeting. I'm going to start by introducing all our panel members who have kindly agreed to subject themselves to your difficult questions. So starting from right, your right to left, we have Sheldon Goldstein from Rutgers University, Travis Norson from Marlborough College, Yakir Aharonov from Tel Aviv and from Chapman University, Chris Fuchs from Perimeter Institute, Christopher Timpson from Oxford University, and Terry Rudolph from Imperial College. So I should say before beginning that Shelley has to leave early to catch plane, so at some point he's going to rush off, and it's not because of anything that people on the panel said or what you've said to him. It just means he's trying to get home. So we had lots of great questions, and I have no idea how to prioritize them, so I'm just going to start with a few of the general questions. So the one that caught my eye was, how does your perspective on the quantum state enable you to make progress in theoretical physics? Thank you. How does your perspective on the quantum state, the interpretation of the quantum state, the nature of the quantum state, enable you or enable us to make progress in theoretical physics? How does it impact our work? Anybody want to field that? I'm going to start with Terry.
Because I'm the least religiously hidebound person here, the only thing I'll say is that it's convenient when you work in quantum information, as I do, to treat states as states of information and knowledge, because you end up in situations where you're having to talk about multiple people who have different information and different knowledge. So even if interpreting the state epistemically is, you know, the wrong thing from the perspective of the fundamental ontology of the universe, it still actually does let us make progress, and there isn't, that's what I would say.
Shelley?
Well, it's important maybe to bear in mind that it certainly affected the progress Bell made in physics, namely his taking the quantum state at least seriously enough to focus on the effects of entanglement led to a really rather significant developments in quantum mechanics.
Chris, why don't you jump in?
Well, the generic point would be that one would think about slightly different things depending on what one thinks there is in the world and how it might behave. And so the heuristics that one's going to find persuasive and useful are going to vary depending on what one's views are. So as Terry says, there's the information view might make doing quantum information theory easier. Being a realist about the universal state might make doing cosmology easier. I think having an open mind about these issues is probably the most fruitful thing to do, and try out how things look in different interpretations rather than definitively closing off various different doors and saying, well, we must definitely think this way. It's probably better to recognize that different ontological questions are posed, and so different avenues will be opened up depending on what we take the fundamental theory to be about. But given that we're not yet in a position to decide the ontological question fully, we'll have to keep an open mind and pursue the various different kinds of perspectives and see where we get to.
Can you repeat the question? I want to catch the flavor of how you're posing it.
How does your perspective on the quantum state enable us to make progress in theoretical physics?
Okay, good. I want to build on what Chris just said. I remember when I was a kid, NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in the United States, was sold to the public, usually through the idea that there would be great spin-offs from going to space, because the common man didn't give a damn about going to the moon. But building on what Chris just said, I started thinking about the few little results that I've been involved with in quantum information. For instance, there's something called a no-broadcasting theorem, which is a generalization of the no-cloning theorem. And the no-broadcasting theorem, I think, has had some uses in quantum cryptography and in questions, technical questions to do with quantum cryptography. But the reason I was interested in that question in the first place was because I thought it gave a distinction or I thought it would give a distinction between classical probability distributions and quantum states. And I thought that the place that one should look for an understanding of quantum states was by comparing them to probability distributions. So I was led to work on this theorem because of my interpretational view. Similarly, with something else I was involved with, the quantum Definetti theorem, it came about because I wanted to have some meaning for the idea of an unknown quantum state from the point of view of quantum states don't exist outside of my head. So I was forced to work on something like that. And once again, it was a spin-off, I think again used in quantum cryptography. So indirectly, these little things that I was pushed to because of interpretational questions have had a life of their own, and they have now gone off, and they're used by cryptographers who could really care less about quantum foundational issues. So it easily and obviously affects theoretical physics, I think, in a broad way. And it probably is the case from all the different interpretational perspectives, though I might challenge some of the other panelists to find spin-offs, say, of this or that foundational approach, at least for quantum engineering, quantum chemistry, quantum information, and identify them if you can.
Well, just coming back quickly to that, maybe Travis was about to say that. So if the challenge was to the people who supported the Debye-Bohm theory, there's a really easy answer to that, and it's Bell's inequality. He never would have posed that question if he hadn't looked at the Bell theory, at the Bohm theory.
Yeah, that's not what I was going to say, and in fact, I'm not even sure that's true. I mean, it's certainly true that Bell's discovery of Bell's theorem was directly motivated by his interest in the Bohm theory, but that's a little bit different than saying it was directly motivated by the particular perspective that the Bohm theory suggests one should take on the quantum state. In answer to the general question, I mean, I certainly don't have any spin-offs to tell anybody about, but, you know, it's in the nature of making progress that one is sort of unwilling to stand pat with some obvious, straightforward reading of where one is. There's a little bit of mixing of metaphors going on there, but I think you get the point. So it seems to me like an attitude like mine, which is to say, to recognize the virtues in something like the de Broglie-Bohm theory, but to have to have this kind of program of, well, maybe the way to understand the quantum state is to read it as some kind of funny summary of, you know, information, if you like, about a whole bunch of other crazy stuff that we haven't really discovered yet going on in ordinary space-time. I mean, that's at least the kind of project which one could fantasize about, leading somewhere interesting, just because it's relatively unexplored. Whereas, for example, sorry, Shelley, but I don't think, like, the view that the quantum state is nomological, I don't see that as really going anywhere. Well, which isn't really an argument against it, but it's an argument that it's less likely to lead to progress.
Well, I sort of tried to argue this morning that it could well go somewhere if you think in those terms. That it is a hard project. But let me add one thing. I think it's important to understand the nature of the objects we're dealing with in physics, like what is the wave function, what is the quantum state. On the other hand, it can also hinder progress in physics. If you have new mathematical objects, which you're using in a theory, which is a very effective theory, and agonizing about the nature of those objects prevents you from comfortably working with the theory, that's not so great. So one should be a little careful about worrying about these things as well. Although, I don't deny it can lead to progress, but it could also do the opposite.
There's another question which is slightly related to this that I wonder if anybody wants to comment.
You want to say something?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
I just wonder, there's a famous example in quantum computation. Can you hear me from down there? Where Bob Griffiths, excuse me for bringing him up again, his consistent history's interpretation, which allowed him under certain circumstances to say that the measurement a qubit revealed a pre-existing value led him to a spectacular simplification of short factoring algorithm that eliminated all the two-qubit gate in favor of measurements. Now, of course, there are other ways of seeing this once it's noticed, but it seems to me the interesting thing that a particular interpretational perspective can do is to play a heuristic role in your thinking, give you funny ways of thinking about things where that conventional ways of thinking about them would be less likely to lead you to. I mean, witness all the extraordinary tricks and paradoxes that have been thrown out of Raffaele and his group over these years. I assume it's because they have managed to twist their minds in such a way that they feel totally at home with this three-state way of doing things, and it clearly has a more serious problem.
I want to kind of add to that. I think it was, I first read it along with Alan and Chan's book, that if you don't have other, he was arguing for other theories than quantum theory, but especially those which might have different predictive content than quantum theory, because he said if you don't have any other theory, you're not going to be actually tested. You won't have the ideas to test the theory in a different way than you might otherwise have. And in my own case, this collapse theory, one of the positive things that it does do, is make suggestions about phenomena which are different than quantum mechanics. And a number of people have done experiments and are proposing experiments which specifically test what happens when we have superpositions, for example, of larger and larger things. I think if the collapse theory hadn't been there, there might not have been such great motivation for doing such things. I think it would have been a motivation, just simply because quantum mechanics seems to apply to small, you want to see how far it goes in large. But this is certainly one example of an experimental test which being committed to a theory gives you such suggestions, and that is progress in physics.
And the question has been raised, okay, what does Bohmian mechanics, what would a Bohmian point of view, what kind of progress could that lead to? I want to raise another historical point. When Max Born was agonizing about the meaning of the wave function, he was thinking of scattering experiments in basically Bohmian terms. A particle goes in, is guided by the wave function, comes out in a certain direction. In that framework, it's very natural to agonize about the probabilities of the various ways it might get scattered. If you weren't thinking in those Bohmian terms, but in a pure wave function-y terms, without particles going this way or that way, it might be a bit strange to be thinking about the probabilities. What Born said at the time, somebody suggested to Born that, well, you know, why don't you look for some sort of deterministic model of scattering, which would be just like Bohmian. He said, no, he doesn't think that's at all possible, but the kind of scattering he was thinking about, the kind of guiding he was thinking about, was a guiding in which the motion was stochastic motion that governed by the wave. What Bohm in his later years did consider a kind of model covered by his ideas.
You've preemptively answered the second question, so I'm now going to put the second question to the rest of the panel, which is, what does the historical development of the quantum formalism suggest about the status of psi? What does the historical development of the quantum formalism suggest about the interpretation of the quantum state? And does anybody have a different view from Shelley?
I think it suggests that we're confused. And we've been confused for a long time, and we're just climbing up the chain. Actually, Terry has strong opinions on this. And where we got the formalism of quantum mechanics? Did we get it from thinking about probabilities, or did we get it from thinking about other things? So Terry will usually tell the story that quantum mechanics was not actually found from some playing around with the formalism of probability theory and thinking of quantum mechanics as some generalized convex set. He would rather say that it was found from looking at spectra and trying to understand spectra. Take it away.
No, that's exactly what I would say.
Therefore.
No comment.
I've forgotten what the original question was. What does the historical development tell us?
You could also interpret it as, does the historical development actually teach us anything? Should we ignore what was historically successful? Or?
Yeah, historically, if the Schrodinger picture hadn't been found for 10 or 15 years and everything was done in the Heisenberg picture, canonically quantized Hamiltonians, and if that was consistent with experiments, we probably wouldn't be sitting here thinking about states would just be the eigenstates of Hamiltonians and that kind of thing. So I think the historical development might have taken us on paths that, you know, that have added to our confusion, but... Did you hear anything I said?
Yes. Maybe I have something to say about the history. As you all know, the history of quantum mechanics started with two parallel developments, one by Heisenberg and the other by Schrödinger. And although they looked at first very different, they were shown to be equivalent, I think, by Dirac first. But, I want to point to a difference between the two and to say that, to some extent, it's a pity that because the Schrödinger equation led to solve all problems so much quicker than the Heisenberg picture was more or less neglected completely. There is a fundamental advantage to the Heisenberg picture compared to the Schrödinger picture, apart from the fact, by the way, that in field theory must use the Heisenberg picture. But in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the Heisenberg picture talks about the evolution of observables, which are function of position momentum, say, for a particle in one dimension. And those are things that can be measured and discussed for individual particle. So the time that you can start with a single particle, and you can look at some operators that can be defined together on a particular state, and you can follow their evolution, and you can measure them on individual particles. So the basic building stone of the Heisenberg picture are things that can be tested and are meaningful for individual particles. What about the Schrödinger equation? Look at this strange animal that it's Psi. Suppose I take the simplest example of a particle that can be just in two boxes, under one state, or I like books, so just one state here and the other state there, so that this is just two vectors in Hilbert space. The general wave function of these two vectors involves two real parameters, which are in a sense the direction of this spin-like variable, call them theta and phi. I prepare this state in the superposition of these two boxes or the direction of spin by using a macroscopic object that has indeed the properties of having a definite theta and phi. But the minute I remove the macroscopic object, I am just left with a single particle with an angle theta and phi. There is absolutely no way to test this, because this, a particle with the state theta and phi and a particle with the state theta prime phi prime are generally not orthogonal to each other. So there is no meaningful experiment that can test the psi for a single particle. So I have to go to an ensemble. And only then, if I have many, many replicas that all have theta and phi, and many replicas that all have theta prime and phi prime, the two vectors become orthogonal. So then I can associate this angle theta and phi only with the ensemble, physical ensemble, and not with each individual particle. So my point is that although we describe each individual particle with psi, in a sense we are doing something that is against the idea that the theory should include only things that can be tested by experiment. So psi for a single particle is something that cannot be associated with a single particle, while the Heisenberg variables can be associated with single particles. And therefore, it's very interesting to see why in history people left completely the Heisenberg picture. And the reason was not only that it was much simpler to solve problems with the Schrödinger picture, but when you try to interpret two-slit experiment, for example, with Heisenberg picture, it becomes very difficult. With wave picture, you understand there's some wave coming here, some wave coming there, you interfere them, but this is, of course, misleading, because these waves for a single particle, these waves are probability waves. They're not something that actually moves them, unless you look at the Broglie idea. So I can tell you one interesting historical fact. I visited Max Planck Institute in the early 60s, and I think it was 1961 And I met Heisenberg, and I asked Heisenberg, how do you interpret the two-slit experiment in your language? And lo and behold, he looked at me and said, I don't know how to do that. I know only how to think about it in the Schrödinger picture. So I taught him how to do it in the Heisenberg picture. I showed to him that if you look for relevant operators that distinguish between psi 1 plus psi 2 and psi 1 minus psi 2, they cannot be polynomials in X and P. They have to be something like displacement operator. And since these are non-analytic functions, you can't expand them as polynomials. So I taught him how to think about these modulo variables, which are the P modulo H over L. He got so excited about it that I was told by his assistant, Peter, not me directly, indirectly, that since that day, till the time he died, every visitor to come there, that came there, he just, the first thing he was telling him how to do it in the Heisenberg picture, the shading. Why? Because the guy was really, he suffered the inferiority complex that all these great friends of his like Pauli and Bohr, the minute when the Schrödinger thing came, they left him, and he was left alone. And the main reason is that they did not see how to think about those problems in the Heisenberg picture. So the minute he discovered how to do that, his pride came back.
He still got the Nobel Prize.
Sorry?
Even if his friends left him, he still got the Nobel Prize.
No, he got the Nobel Prize before they left him, I think. It was pretty soon after he did it, no? I don't know how long did he have to wait for the Nobel Prize. I think
in the ninth, was it 31?
It was pretty soon after, when not everybody left
him
yet.
Not too much earlier. It wasn't 29. Schrödinger equation was 27.
I'm not sure I'm convinced entirely by the argument there of the fundamental dissimilarity between the Heisenberg and the Schrödinger picture. The claim seemed to be that because we couldn't determine the states for individual particles just by measurements on a single copy of the particle, that meant we couldn't really believe in the size for a single particle, yet we could determine the pertinent physical quantities in the Heisenberg picture. Yet what are those quantities? They're expectation values.
No. You discard for every psi, you have the thing that I called Eigen operators, which are, if you have Hilbert space with n vectors, the space of all operators that you can measure, emission operators, is n square dimensional,
sure.
Real Hilbert space, sure. real vector space. Out of this n minus 1 square plus 1 are operators for which this state is Eigenstate. That means that all those things you can measure without disturbing the state, and you know that there is a subspace of all operators that you can measure on a single state without disturbing it, and you have definite answer. And then the prediction is how this subspace moves as a function of time. So there is a meaning to discuss individual things, not averages, but measurement on individual systems.
The related point I was going to make, now, I take that point. The existence of quantum state tomography, the possibility of determining the state of systems when we assume we have repeated, identically prepared systems, there's an amusing historical fact, or it amuses me anyway, here. So Band and Park, in a paper back in the 60s or 70s, were some of the first people I noticed who went through the mathematics of that. And their conclusion was that, similar to the one I think that you were drawing, that because one could only determine the states for many repeated copies of the system, really the state only applied to the system. To that lot. Richard Yoser, from exactly the same mathematics, from the fact that you could determine the state psi from the n copies, concluded exactly the opposite, namely that there was a fact about what the state of the individual systems was. Why make that move instead? Because you think, well, if I think there is that state for the individual system, that explains why I get the statistics that I get for the other one. Anyway, it just strikes me as amusing that from exactly the same mathematics, the different physicists will diametrically oppose interpretation of conclusions.
I know, but nevertheless, if you do not have all these replicas, you will never be able to tell what the psi is. So, okay, there are many nice, many interesting things to say about it.
Let me have one follow-up question to you, Yekir, among the ones that were asked. So in the two-vector formalism,
yes.
So in this conference, we've been talking about different possibilities for the interpretation of quantum state. One would be it represents reality directly. Another would be it's like the probability distribution over phase space in Liouville mechanics. It just represents an ensemble of systems, or it represents some observer's knowledge of an individual system. And then other talks, like Shelley's talked about, maybe it's more law-like. So the question is, what is the appropriate status? How do you think about the quantum state in your formalism?
Yeah, I think that it's very important to notice the difference between getting negative number in this formalism, for example, for things that must be positive, like a projection operator, and getting a negative number of distribution in phase space, like the Big Morale distribution. You see, if you, the Big Morale distribution corresponds to a single vector. In a single vector, the average of a projection operator must always be positive. Therefore, the thing that gives you a negative value, if you look at the Big Morale distribution, that areas smaller than h bar in the inner space cannot correspond to the average of a projection operator or density. It cannot be sort of density. In fact, the thing that gives you that value is the average of the parity operator, which is the most non-local thing. While what I'm talking about when the two with the two vectors, I'm actually talking about a real experiment that measures bona fide densities. Just the same experiment I will do to measure densities classically. For example, if I want to know how many particles I have in a given box, and I know that they are charged, I will take a test particle outside and see what force it feels. This is a bona fide measurement, a good measurement of how many particles that is. There are, and of course it has uncertainties because the coupling to each individual is very, very weak. And that thing gives me negative number. This negative number is an average of a density operator. But because these are two vectors, it gives me this negative number. So therefore, there is absolutely no similarity between the distribution in the Big Morale distribution in phase space and the kind of new distribution that I'm talking about.
So is your conclusion that unlike the Morale distribution, which goes negative, and which teaches us that
This is a mathematical trick to get something, while the thing that I'm talking about, these new weak values, these are not mathematical tricks. They are actually results for good experiments that classically you would say these are the correct experiment to measure up to a given accuracy the quantity you are talking about. While if you try to do the analogy experiment that classically will check a point in phase space is the integral of e to the I alpha x plus beta p over the alpha d beta. That thing classically will check indeed if you are at a point in phase space, quantum mechanically gives you the parity operator. So it blows in your face. You try to do what you can't do and then you get an impossible thing. Now, what I'm doing is really discussing actual experiments, good experiments, not exact one, but because it's a weak measurement, but good experiments. The thing that classically you will call a measurement of density, how many particles there are, gives you now even imaginary number, and I can now come, quantum mechanics teaches me how to take Maxwell equation and put sources on the right side that are complex.
So you don't want to interpret it in the same way as the Morale distribution?
That's right, yeah.
Now, really would you interpret it as an instrumental device, like, you know, Schrodinger's catalog of expectations,
or is it reality? I'm telling you that just like up to now we say that observables have eigenvalues as a result of experiments, right, the eigenvalues. Now I'm telling you, you have to generalize it and say that results of experiments, if they are done in a way that will not disturb the quantum system and you have pre and post selection, these are the values. These are the physical values that describe the system, which is pre and post selected. Just like eigenvalues describe the system when you made a strong experiment to find what it is. These are really new physical properties of quantum systems that have no classical analog, because in classical theory you can't do pre and post selection. It generalizes our concept of what physical properties are of systems.
Okay, thanks. Next question. So in other areas of science, because concern is more with explanations of experimental data through causal mechanisms rather than what is real. And then the follow-up is, I guess, a bit of a jab at the whole topic of the conference, which is, should we actually be worrying about what's real in our formalism, or would it be more appropriate to be asking for causal mechanisms and for explanations of the phenomena we see? So I'm hoping that maybe somebody on the panel wants to defend the topic of the conference, but you can also jump in and attack the topic.
Can I ask for a clarification of the question? Was that two questions from two different people?
No, weird.
It seems to me that in order to causally explain something, the thing that you're explaining and the thing that's doing the explanatory work better both exist, or it isn't really a causal explanation. So it seems to me quite important, actually, to figure out what really exists before you can really have any hope of having causal explanations of anything that you can take seriously.
I agree.
Chris, do you want to say anything about causation, the role of causation?
Me too.
Good. Maybe it's worth pointing out, then, that the reason that other sciences don't seem to need to have conferences about this is just that they've already somehow or other figured this out.
Well, you know, in the grand scale of physics, I don't think we have conferences either. This is a very small fraction, just a little minor disturbance on the American Physical Society, I would think.
At best.
I mean, perhaps another way to put Travis's point is that it's probably misleading to suppose that the other sciences aren't engaged in the business of thinking about what's real. The stuff they say is indirectly going to be committing them to a whole bunch of planes. And indeed, they're quite happy when they're giving the results of experiments. They're not denying that the lab and the bench and so on exist. They're not denying that the systems they're investigating exist. And they typically won't be denying that the properties they're postulating to explain what they get exist. Now, they might not feel the need to actually say that because it might not be an urgent problem to separate out what might be a part of the mathematical representation of the phenomena from the actual physical facts one's trying to draw on. But, I mean, so what's the message? Quantum mechanics or fundamental physics in general is hard and tricky. And there are specific problems, particularly in the highly mathematized way in which we deal with things. There are specific problems about what bits of the mathematical theory do we need to take as representing reality. So it's not that ordinary science doesn't bother talking about what's real. It presupposes. It's totally immersed, swimming in the sea of the real and talking about the real.
Yes, Hugh.
I think it's also worth pointing out some other sciences do have corresponding issues. For example, some of my colleagues in Sydney, philosophy and biology, are very much involved in some ways, very analogous debates about, say, the notion of a gene. The notion of a gene that we probably have as people, this is probably a highly naive one. I think for them, it's a serious question as to whether if there isn't really any such gene.
On the subject of philosophy of biology, we had a question regarding whether fruit flies have a use in quantum foundations as well as genetics. I have a sense that that's connected. So, Hans, can you take the mic to Mike? Yes.
I mean, it's a question I heard the other day. That you can put to anti-realists at parties, if indeed they go to parties, which I thought would amuse you. It goes like this. We now know that 60 carbon atom fullerene cages, or cookie balls, if you like, can be used in a double-slit experiment. Okay, you fire them one by one through the apparatus, and they end up clustering in interference maxima. So a cookie ball is small enough to be a genuine quantum particle. Now, the real killer experiment is as follows, published just last month. Some guys showed that if you put buckyballs on the feet of a fruit fly, then it loses its ability to climb walls. Now, A caricature anti-realist would say that buckyballs would only adopt a definite position if they were observed by a conscious observer. So I guess my question is as follows. Do the panel think that if only the fly had the good sense to stop looking at its own feet, then it would regain its ability to climb walls?
Well, so there are flavors and there are flavors of anti-realists. So, for example, one might be an entity realist, but not a realist about theories. What would that difference consist in? It would be that, well, one believes there are buckyballs, but I'm not going to believe any or very much of the theory about them. I might believe some direct causal claims that involve buckyballs, like if I got a big crate of them and dropped them on your head, then it would squash you. Or they can cause fruit flies to lose their climbing ability. But I'm not going to be committed, the entity realist might not be further committed to any detailed, taking seriously any detailed description of the properties to the buckyballs. So, for example, they might not want to specify a detailed, as it were, quantum ontology for them, or a set of variables which provided a complete dynamical description. So those kind of characters aren't going to have any problem. So, well, I'm some flavor of anti-realist, but not that flavor. The broadest, the most extreme form of anti-realist,
which is called Chris Fuchs.
No. So Chris is rather more in that camp. He's more similar to the entity realist, but not theory realist. It's true that if one subscribes to a general form of anti-realism, not specifically anti-realism about scientific objects. So if one thought that all claims ultimately reduced to claims about sense data, so all physical object language talk was reducible to sense data talk, then what the fruit fly thinks is going on with its foot probably might make a difference. But I don't think anybody really ought to subscribe to that kind of extreme anti-realism, and certainly it's not something that specific views, specific special purpose anti-realism views in the foundations of quantum mechanics would require. But I like the story.
I actually have something to say about that that's maybe too serious, given the nature of the question. But I think the question is intended as a kind of reductio ad absurdum of, you know, the idea that some particular kind of interaction, like observation, can have some kind of causal influence on what exists or how it exists. Even as someone who's a realist, though, I don't actually have the slightest problem with that whatsoever. And I think that thinking that that's the problem with ordinary quantum mechanics is actually a mistake and a confusion. And the problem with ordinary quantum mechanics is the vagueness and the shiftiness, rather than the idea that somehow observation plays a different role, or that there's some kind of, you know, split between the macroscopic and the microscopic.
On this, as we're asking the anti-realists to justify themselves, but we're not calling anyone an anti-realist. There is a question directed towards...
Sorry, Rob. I just shortly comment on buckyball's experiment? Actually, it seems that the picture you have about the buckyballs depends on an experimental condition in which you observe the buckyballs. So there was a time that people, really, theoreticians, thought that this experiment will not succeed simply because buckyball is sufficiently large to be a classical object. And it is indeed. You can put it on surface and look at the electronic microscope, you will see the buckyballs there. But the experiment succeeded for a simple reason, that even these buckyballs are sufficiently large and even can be understood some conditions considered as a black body that radiate, the wavelength that they radiate was not sufficiently small such that you can read out the wave path information out of the interference experiment. And that's the moment where you cannot speak anymore about the localized particles. So what I wanted to say, that this is a nice example of something where you cannot draw the line because it's small or large or whatever, but you have to think about the picture you will have in your mind, independent of experimental talk context.
Okay, so there's another question here, and I'm going to generalize it a little bit to make it more open. So it was originally directed at Chris Fuchs, and asked basically whether he would change his mind and embrace a deterministic ontological model if a far more compelling theory than the present hidden variable theories emerged. But I guess I want to maybe generalize the question as follows, that often it's said in the philosophy of science that your theory should be falsifiable, so there should be something that would come to pass that would lead you to abandon your cherished notions. And so maybe I'll just put it out as, you know, what sorts of evidence would lead any of you to abandon what you currently think is the best approach to interpreting the quantum state?
What sort of evidence for what?
What sort of evidence would lead you to change your mind about the status of the quantum state, its interpretation? Why don't we start with Chris Fuchs?
If you could clone a quantum state, I wouldn't think that a quantum state were a state of knowledge. If you could measure a single instance of a quantum state and find out its identity, I wouldn't think that it would be a state of knowledge. If if an eavesdropper with some very powerful equipment could break the BB84 quantum cryptographic protocol, I wouldn't believe that it was a state of knowledge. So I think just any number of these phenomena, I think, would turn me around.
As a footnote, you've answered another question, which is whether if Antony Valentini's predictions about quantum non-equilibrium were experimentally confirmed. And I think some of those predictions would have that flavor. And I think your answer to that question would be, if indeed those sorts of predictions...
If indeed, because I base the whole, or much of the... of exactly the way I see quantum states on these phenomena from quantum information that have analogs in classical phase spaces. And that was at least the beginning point of this move that I've made. So I think I am up. I am open to refutation of.
Howard wants to jump in.
Yeah. So since I was the one who set the original question, I did deliberately word it the way I did rather than the more general way that you did, because you gave Chris such an easy out, right? So he said, of course I'll abandon my views if they're shown experimentally to be wrong. But I was deliberately asking, is there any purely theoretical or aesthetic argument that could possibly change your mind, or do you think that's impossible? And that would go for anyone who I guess that can apply either way. I think I had another argument that goes the other way, but, yeah.
What was the difference? What was the distinction?
I'm not asking. Assume there is no experimental evidence that disproves your view. I'm asking whether any theoretical argument could possibly change your mind.
Any theoretical argument that would change my mind?
So the original question was, if there was a hidden variable theory that everyone agreed was far more compelling than, and maybe is based on, you know, a new quantum theory of gravity or who knows what, you know, that everyone thinks is far more compelling than, yeah, you know, any of the ones which you currently give no credence to.
Yeah.
I remember
some years ago I was obsessed with a certain problem in quantum information about the additivity of channel capacities, quantum channel capacities. And Peter Shor showed that it reduced to a rather simple question. If you have two copies of a channel, there's a point to this story. If you have two copies of a channel, you can ask, what state can I put through the channel, through these two copies, that will lead to the minimum output entropy, right at the output? And people struggled with this problem, trying to prove that the optimal state to put into these two channels is just a product state. Only recently, after, 15 years, have we learned that actually that's not true. Generally, an entangled state will lead to less entropy for a sufficiently contrived channel. But at the time that I was working on that sticky problem, I thought, and I still think, if a Bohmian were to come up to me and say, if you would just think of this in Bohmian terms, then, and here's the answer. If a Bohmian were to walk up to me today and solve one of these sticky problems that doesn't come out of their community, but comes out of my community, then I think I would reexamine whether that's perhaps a better way to think about quantum states and the interpretation of quantum mechanics than I give them credit for at the moment. So, yeah, I guess in that sense, some kind of theoretical arguments work, but the ones that usually work on me are ones with a kind of cash value. Well, the main thing that would impress me is if they solve a problem that comes from outside of their community, not necessarily mine. It might well be, yeah. Well, I've heard some of things like that. So,
what about the contextuality? I mean, Bell was early on, well, in the 64, proving that any theory has to be contextual, and that was before Cauchon and Speckle. That's I don't. If you call Bell a Bohmian, then that's sort of outside the field, right? Or
I mean, the sorts of problems that people generally mention in foundations are of a different flavor than the one I was trying to convey. So here's a non-foundational problem. It's just an open question in physics. Because after all, I think that what we should be doing is looking for a point of view that helps people solve problems in physics, not just solve problems in foundations for foundation's sake, so that we can continue to have year after year another damn conference like this one. That's of a different flavor. It's true that thinking about Bohmian issues led Bell to prove some really important theorems. That's great. But those theorems were directly posed at foundational issues. I'm just asking for the workaday physicist. I come from blue-collar roots. It seems to me that we foundationalists should give the workaday physicist something he or she can use. And if a point of view does that, then that's a selling point for the point of view, be it Bohmian, be it many worlds, dare I say, be it quantum Bayesian.
Are there anybody else who want to comment on falsifiability and what would lead you to change your beliefs? Terry?
I think I could possibly be persuaded to Chris's point of view if I could see a program that had some more realism in it. I'm frustrated with the 100% Bayesian program, but if I could see somehow to actually get some physics to do with the actual things that go on in labs around the world, the actual things we do in our actual practice of quantum mechanics, then I'd be prepared to say, well, you know, there is this new type of information theory, and I should just embrace that aspect of it. But where it stands now, I think that program is completed. What Chris and Rudiger and people need to do is to start thinking, where do they go next? And if they come up with something compelling, I think I could embrace it. But at the moment, I'm skeptical.
I think Terry has the right attitude, actually. You complimented what I just said.
I'm concerned there's something not quite right about this sort of association of, you know, concrete practical problems for blue-collar physicists with particular interpretational camps. I mean, in some sense, Chris, all of the problems that you have in mind are just problems for quantum mechanics and not problems that have any proprietary relationship whatsoever to a Bayesian approach versus a Bohmian approach or anything. So I don't know, I kind of don't get the point. Like, I don't understand why it should impress you that a Bohmian happens to show up with an unexpected solution to one of your problems, unless, of course, that solution is somehow really clearly built on the, you know, Bohmian aspect of that person's work. But that, to me, is completely implausible that it could or should be.
So my only response is that the philosophy of pragmatism, the idea that theoretical conceptions should have some value, Because why? Well, how would we ever confirm whether our theories are right or wrong? Let's just see how they work and how useful they are. Anyway, the philosophy of pragmatism, which is what I was just espousing an instance of, is foreign to many minds. So you confirm that.
But look, the whole, I mean, the whole standard textbook, you know, operator structure of quantum mechanics is a theorem for Bohmian mechanics. So it's sort of unreasonable to expect that, you know, the kind of problem that you have in mind is going to be in any way influenced by someone's Bohmian perspective. And I don't really disagree with your attitude that, like, the Bohmian perspectives in the long run somehow should,
I disagree.
Pay its dues by giving rise to some new discoveries or something, but let's not fool ourselves about what such discoveries probably will look like. We probably have no idea what they will look like, and they'll be something more along the lines of quantum cosmology or something just completely unexpected, and they will be, oh, a Bohmian happened to figure out how to do, you know, one of the things that you're talking about.
All I can say is I disagree. I think what we're looking for are more or less powerful techniques for this or that set of problems. And all I'm saying is if a Bohmian can beat me to the solution to a problem by invoking Bohmian imagery, Bohmian, the equations for particle position, any of the apparatus of Bohmianism, if they can beat me to the solution of some problem, that's a selling point for them. And that's cool. It's a selling point for them. And it would make me pay more attention. Now, it is true that after he beats me to the mark and you know, proves some theorem that I couldn't prove, then with hindsight, I could go back and redo it by my sloppy, slow methods. That's always going to be true. If I solve something first, he can go back and solve it by his methods or vice versa. But my test is who gets to the finish line first.
Question for Chris. Did Griffith's refinement of the Shor algorithm make you more sympathetic to consistent histories?
That's a good question. And it should have. No, I can tell a story along these lines when Bob and Nicolas Jussin and Asher Perez and someone else and I wrote a paper once on optimal eavesdropping on BB84. No, it wasn't that good. It was a student of Griffith's. Anyway, when we were writing this paper, we found an optimal eavesdropping strategy by just purely theoretical means. Then it came time to construct a circuit, quantum circuit, for doing this. And Bob's student, Qixin knew something like that. Bob's student found the circuit. And then Bob wrote up an exposition of it and sent it out to us, and it was all in consistent histories language. And Asher Perez said, "We will not have this in the paper." And Nicolas Jussin said, "We will not have this in the paper." And Bob Griffith said, "Well, then show me a way of deriving this circuit without consistent histories." And at that point, Asher and Jussin and I was too lazy to even check. The paper split into two. And so Bob was on one half, and then he and his student did another half all alone doing the circuit. So Bob said, the only way to understand this is consistent histories. Well, some years later, I met the student again, and I said, well, it was true. You found it with the consistent histories formalism. And he said, no, I found the circuit and I showed it to him. So, yeah, if I were to be consistent, you know, I've often given the argument that one should pay more attention to Everetti in quantum mechanics, precisely because David Deutsch got to the first interesting quantum algorithm, and he was motivated to find the algorithm because he was thinking of many worlds terms. So, if I were to refine my answer, I would say you give me some set of phenomena, you know, some sufficiently large. And of course, we're all like this. You have to be beat over the head a few times before you start taking on a new point of view. So.
So well,
I'm weak, is what I'm saying.
I'd like to restate also the sort of cosmological point of view. So at this conference, we have seen Nelson's talk, where something which has worried me for a very long time, that you have the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is a real equation, but yet the solution space is for complex wave functions, and you have the real and imaginary part there, not communicating, not talking with each other. And that creates a paradox when you want to look at, when you want to reproduce quantum mechanics with subsystems, because there's an I there and the real and imaginary part communicates. Now, I need to understand this much better, but this apparently just falls out exactly for this class of models which Nelson was considering. And this is ordinary inflationary models also. So this I think is important. Of course, it's not quantum information theory, but it's in cosmology.
Thanks, Hans. So I want to turn the tables on the question rather than asking those with an information theoretic bent what would convince them that other more realist interpretations would convince them. I'm going to ask those with more realist leanings to answer the following question, which I'm going to paraphrase. There's been some progress recently on axiomatizing quantum theory in terms of information theoretic axioms. And it seems that coming up with axioms is not something that takes place in the Bohmian community or the many worlds community. And so maybe I'll start with Travis. The question was, what, if anything, along the lines of deriving quantum mechanics from simple information theoretic arguments would convince you to embrace the Fuchsian view, or more generally, a more information theoretic type view?
By the way, I'm not supposed to finish at 5.
Oh, look at the time. Well, happily, the question, I believe, was phrased, what if anything, ... which makes it kind of easy to answer. I mean, I don't think anything. I'm just sort of not interested.
I'm more flexible.
That's probably true.
Little less religious.
But there are certain things that it's appropriate to hold fast to, and not for religious reasons, but because one has proper scientific certainty in them. Such claims as that there is a world external to one, for example.
That's not being denied by the quantum Bayesian.
Not in word, but...
Not indeed, either.
Jerry?
Travis specifically about the nature of the wave function. About the realism and anti-realism and so on, just in terms of, you know, ontic status or otherwise, the wave function, what would convince you that maybe seeing it as an epistatic object, you know, obviously we then have to find the realistic structure underneath.
Well, yeah, I'm already very far leaning in the direction of not being realist about the quantum state at all, so... I mean, I think I said openly that I have sort of no horse in that race between the psi-ontic and psi-epistemic distinction.
So there's the sort of two levels of epistemic and so on. And ontic.
Right, so as long as we're talking about, like, look, there's an external reality and the psi-epistemic program is some kind of hidden variables theory program in which it, you know, just so happens that... you know, the ontic state doesn't uniquely define the quantum state, then, you know, show me a theory like that that, you know, works and is, you know, well-motivated and sensible and plausible-looking, and I'd be more than happy to believe it. But I'm not going to, I mean, there's no theory you're going to show me or development you're going to show me that's going to convince me to be epistemic in the other.
What about the sort of things that Rob has done where you list a whole bunch of phenomena that you can recover without necessarily having a, you know, a handle on deeper reality, but just saying, look, if I think that the state is an interesting...
I'm sitting here and I listen to all this discussion, and it's as if all what I said in my lecture is completely irrelevant, because I have shown that it's, if you have enough replicas, You actually test all, can test everything in quantum mechanics without disturbing the system, so it's really there. What I'm talking about is really there. It's not something that you have to argue whether it's there or not, because each time you do a measurement, you disturb the thing. I don't understand why.
How do you explain the fact that there's no strong measurement that can. But how do you explain the fact that there's no strong measurement that can identify the quantum state? There's no strong measurement that can identify the quantum state of a system. So do you have something to say as to why that's the case? Why is it only with these funny weak measurements one can do so?
I simply think that the whole idea of having uncertainties is exactly the minimum thing that you need in order to have a consistent way of the future affecting the present. So if a strong experiment wouldn't have disturbed the system, I would be back in the classical case, and then the time is just one directional. But here I'm showing that it's the minimum that you need in order to have this consistent picture of the past and the future affecting the present. You must have the minimum uncertainty all around for the system, for the measuring device, and that must mean that a strong measurement must disturb the system. So I can deduce all of that from this new kind of approach. I think he gave me a good challenge to start with just this idea and to get quantum mechanics out of that. That's a really interesting challenge. So, and I promise that by the time I come back, I will either raise a triumph or a white flag saying that I retire from that idea.
Okay. Well, yeah. On that note, I think let's conclude the panel discussion. Yeah. And let's thanks all our